Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Over the summer, the Mount Hood National Forest Service proposed cutting trees along over 200 miles of roads within the 2020 Riverside Fire area. BARC, a community organization who has trained hundreds of volunteers about the basics of forest policy and saved tens of thousands of acres of forest from logging and road building, submitted recommendations to reshape the Forest Service's proposal that would have allowed aggressive logging activities in a sensitive post-fire ecosystem. After months of hard work and collaboration, the Forest Service is taking BARC's advice. Today we talk with Michael Kratka, BARC's Forest Watch Coordinator, who has been keeping a close eye on what's going on in the Mount Hood National Forest since the fires raged last year. Michael, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thanks so much for having me on the show and allowing me to talk about a place I care about so much.
Well, this is a place a lot of us care about. We're talking today about the Clackamas River watershed, and particularly the area that burned in the Riverside Fire last summer. And a lot of changes have happened because of the fire and because of post-fire practices. So, Michael, you were out there back in the spring and summer, and I'm curious why you wanted to go out there, because very few people were actually getting to go on the ground at that time to see what the Forest Service and ODOT and other agencies were doing.
Right. So for the past few years, especially, BARC's been tracking wildfires in the state and the response to those by, you know, state and federal agencies. And, you know, as we all know, huge parts of Oregon's national forest have been closed since the 2020 Labor Day fires that happened. You know, there were over 850,000 acres that were burned, and which that included, but wasn't limited to, the Riverside Fire in Mount Hood National Forest, the Lionshead Fire, and the Beechey Creek fires in our part of the state. And so on Mount Hood National Forest, where BARC works, there were over 110,000 acres that were burned, which, you know, that's 10% of the entire national forest. And a lot more area than that was closed for a really long time. And it was closed immediately after the fire started. So the day of that big wind event on Labor Day, and that was the same day as the ignition of the Riverside Fire, there was an immediate evacuation of the entire Clackamas Corridor, because that was deemed unsafe at that time to try to even, you know, attempt to suppress the fire on the national forest. And, you know, over the course of just that one day, the fire moved 17 miles west along the Clackamas River, and, you know, the vast majority of the fire burned within those couple of days, and that whole corridor has been closed ever since then. And as soon as the smoke cleared, you know, agencies like ODOT and the Forest Service, they began making these really hard and important decisions about kind of how to approach this changed landscape, given, you know, what had just happened. And that conversation moved really quickly to, as you've talked about before, I think on your show, cutting trees along the fire-impacted roads and the wild and scenic corridors that we all know, like the Clackamas River, that are just so highly valued by Oregonians. And so we always knew that the opportunity for public input on those kinds of activities was going to be really minimal to none, and there was going to be no public access, which is really troublesome, since, you know, the things that happen in response to these fires, they're going to have really lasting impacts on people's future experience of the forest. And so, you know, both Forest Service and the ODOT, Oregon Department of Transportation, they proposed to carry out these tree removal activities with this stated reason that they can't reopen the forest until the trees that could potentially cause a safety hazard are removed. And, you know, I think it's important to recognize those agencies. They did have a lot of challenging trade-offs to consider when it came to making decisions about what to do about access. You know, on one hand, if they moved really fast to reopen the forest, that, you know, obviously provides some recreation and economic opportunities to some of the communities around the cicada, for example, that have, you know, been hit so hard. But it can cause a lot of harm if it's done too quickly or without the right context. And so, you know, right away we knew that these projects were important to track, and we decided that it was important to try to get out into the forest somehow to see what the conditions looked like on the ground and what these agencies were doing early on into the fire recovery and response effort by both the state and the federal government. So, yeah, that's kind of the reason.
How did you get in there? Because I remember, I mean, Dan Sears told me he tried a couple times to go in there, and one time he actually got a ticket for walking along a road that was not even obviously closed. How is Bark able to manage to not just even drive in, but actually to see the whole burn area by air?
Right, yeah. So, well, before we went in by air, I think that we did a little bit of poking around along the edges, kind of like Dan did. Right after the fire burned, I drove around a little bit around kind of like the Hillock Burn Road area, sort of near out near Dodge, kind of around sort of the outer, I guess, western edge of where the fire had burned. And there was a lot you could see from there. There was a lot of industrial forest land and ag land and a lot of homes, and a lot of them had been burned. There was still cleanup happening at that point. And getting out to that area also really motivated me to try to get out into the forest because I saw, especially on that industrial forest land, some things happening that, we really did not want to see on the national forest. Just post-fire clear cutting, just, these large forest landowners just liquidating their assets. And it was, some of the gnarliest post-fire clear cutting I'd ever seen. So around that time, I started talking with folks from the Crag Law Center and some other groups about, what potential there was to be able to get out into the forest. And, we had contacted the Forest Service at that point, and they were like, no, we can't have that happen. ODOT's doing their work on the 224. It's too dangerous. It's too much of a hassle. And so we ended up arranging a helicopter flyover of the Clackamas with the help of Crag Law Center. This was about 6 months after the Riverside fire, and I felt enormously blessed to be able to be on that helicopter ride. It was a really surreal experience, I think, because I think at the time part of me was still really in denial about what I was about to see, and I think that's probably a pretty common thing after these big landscape changing events happened. And the forest really had changed. When we flew over, there was still a lot of green in many areas, and a lot of areas were still pretty recognizable. But then, there were areas like Fish Creek and parts of the South Fork of the Clackamas where you could see that just almost the entire drainage had burned really severely, and there just wasn't a green tree in sight. And that was something that was really different, I think, about this fire. Just the sheer amount of high severity fire that occurred within those first few days. It was just, I think like something like almost half of the Riverside fire burned in high severity, which is pretty high in my experience looking at these fires.
How did that compare with the way that the Eagle Creek fire burned in 2017?
Oh, well, so I think that the Eagle Creek fire was, oh, shoot. I mean, it was much smaller than the Riverside fire, and there was much more of an even spread, or I should say a normal spread of, low, mid, and high severity. Most fires that burn under quote unquote normal fire weather, which, it's debatable what normal means anymore, but the contribution of high severity fire that happens within that fire perimeter is usually pretty low. And, something like the Riverside fire, the reason that it was able to spread so quickly and so severely really had to do with that uptick of winds that we had on that first day, mixed with, all the dry vegetation and the drought leading up to that. So just really in its scale and severity, the Riverside fire and all these other Labor Day fires that happened, they're just kind of in a different ballpark than the Eagle Creek fire, for sure.
Well, I've heard the stories that I've heard have made me really dread to go out there. I mean, I've been really wanting to go, and I haven't found a way yet to get to the places that I want to see. But when you say that Fish Creek is completely burned and describing that drainage, which I know really well, I'm trying to imagine what it feels like when you see a forest that you love and that you've spent immense amounts of time in just transformed into charred trees.
Yeah, it's true that it's a hard thing to see. I think that it's going to take a lot of getting used to. For folks that haven't been there, I think that emotionally preparing yourself a little bit for what you're about to see, because I think especially around some of the areas that the roadside logging that's occurred, there were areas along the 224 that it just, it took looking at the video footage later after we did this flyover to even kind of register that we had passed the Roaring River campground because it was completely clear cut.
You said something in the email that you sent out after you took the helicopter flight, where you were describing what looked like healthy burn patterns and that this was a forest that could regenerate itself until you came to what you're just describing. So I wanted to kind of talk first about what happened that was actually good for forest health and then what happened that was exactly the opposite.
Right. Yeah. So, kind of side note also, I'm sure the Clackamas River Corridor has amazing geology. And that was much more visible. You could see all the hidden waterfalls, going over the South Fork and everything like that. But yeah, so there were what looked like hundreds of thousands of dead trees. And it is jarring, and fire is scary, and it can cause a lot of chaos and destruction and death when it interacts with human communities. But yes, we also do need to recognize that the forests we love and depend on, they were created by fire. It shaped them over time, and they depend on fire now. And they are in very many ways adapted to fire. There's the trees that survived out in the Riverside Fire, many of them survived because they were adapted to it. They have thick, fire-resistant bark. On the flyover and on subsequent trips I've taken into these burns on the ground, you can see trees that are resprouting at the base after their crowns burn off. There are seeds that germinate after fire that really depend on that, the heat and the openings that are created. And that habitat that the fire creates is really critical. It's something that's foresters often call early seral habitat, and it's something that has been historically lacking on the landscape due to fire suppression, and it's something that oftentimes I think logging attempts to emulate, but I just can't do it. With these early forests come this high plant diversity, wildflower blooms, just increases of wildlife use, birds and insects that just go nuts over the new food and habitat resources that become available after a fire. And all of that dead wood, the fire kills trees, and that dead wood, that also has a lot of value. Birds, mammals, amphibians, what we're probably going to see over the next number of years on the Clackamas River is, flashier river conditions just due to all of the soil burn severity that happened. And so we're going to see more floods and more debris flows and more sediment entering the Clackamas, which, you might think of as detrimental in the short term to salmon and other aquatic life, but in the long term, those river systems really depend on that influx of dead wood and sediment and the dynamic changes in geomorphology that occur. So I think people should think about places that they've been, like this year. If you've been able to get out to the Columbia River Gorge and hike any of the trails that reopened since the fire that happened there, that's a pretty good indicator of what things are going to look like in many places in the Riverside Fire in a few years from now once things start to green up again. And it's a really beautiful thing when it happens.
So, what's the not so beautiful part of what's going on now?
On that helicopter ride, we definitely saw a lot of these road networks that we already knew were being proposed for cutting as part of, ODOT and the Forest Service's roadside hazard tree removal effort. As we went up the 224, we saw that ODOT they were beginning work on kind of their phase two of their roadside tree removal effort. So this was April, I think early April, and so they had already went through and completed sort of their immediate phase one. And phase two, they're working back from kind of the Ripplebrook area back toward west towards Estacada. And so, you could already see that there were hillsides of trees that were moved, up to hundreds of feet away from the highway at that point. And PGE, it didn't help that PGE also has an energy corridor along the 224, and so they had also done a lot of tree removal work as well. There was, to me, like I mentioned, there's a lot of these well-known areas, campgrounds, day use areas, boat launches along the Clackamas River, and some of them I recognized. But places like the Roaring River and the Sunsert Campground, it's they were so close to the 224 that ODOT just went in there and cut all the trees down, unfortunately. And we also saw a lot of trees that were marked to cut or had already been cut that were way down slope from the road, down next to the river in the riparian corridor, which, when you think about it, when those trees fall, they're going to fall down to the river. They're not going to jump back up to the road. But I think the most jarring thing that I saw during that flight was what I saw along the Highway 46, which I didn't really expect to see very much activity happening there.
You're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Michael Crockta, BARC's Forest Watch Coordinator, about post-fire logging in the Mount Hood National Forest. So what was the most disturbing thing that you saw?
Yeah, so I think the most disturbing, kind of jarring, unexpected thing that I saw was really the Highway 46 and the work that had been done there. I didn't really expect very much roadside logging to have occurred in that area. And so this area I'm talking about, if people are familiar with the Clackamas Corridor, once you head south from the Ripplebrook area, and the 224 kind of turns into the 46, you head south kind of down towards the Kalawash and the upper Clackamas that eventually ends up all the way over near Brightonbush. We saw a lot of heavy cutting along that highway, which is a Forest Service road. So we knew it wasn't ODOT that did it. And that also includes a lot of heavy logging right along the Riverside Trail, which a lot of people are familiar with. It's a riverside trail that goes right through a ton of amazing old growth forest. And apparently a lot of this logging along Highway 46, it was done last fall in the early winter to, provide safety, quote unquote, for, the suppression and repair and reconnaissance work. And many of the trees that we saw cut, we actually noted they were cut really recently. They were still green. A lot of them were hundreds of feet away from the road. And some of the areas were right along that riverside trail, in the campgrounds and all these other popular river spots. And obviously within that Clackamas River Wild and Scenic Corridor. And, we saw trees that were cut that we estimated to be something like 700 feet away from the road, significantly downslope on a bench along the river. And it would take something like a tornado to get the trees like up from that bench up onto the road, and trees that had been felled into wetlands along there. And we ended up submitting photos of all of that to the Forest Service, who, they took a field trip to look at things on the ground. After they had that field visit, they acknowledged that the work wasn't perfect. There were some mistakes that were made, but it just, in that environment and the timing, it just wasn't possible for the work to be done better. And went on to explain the liability of leaving any potential danger trees out there. To me, it was just really sad to see this part of the forest with so much of that beautiful old growth, right along the river, just in that impacted state. And I think it's something for folks that are familiar with that area in particular to really brace themselves for, because that was a change that I did not expect to see.
Well, I first heard about the logging that was going on the lower part of 46 right near Detroit, particularly right around the Brightonbush area. Samantha Kropp told me about it last spring, and I was just devastated when I learned about that. What you're describing up a little bit further north is equivalent to the kinds of clear cutting that went on around Brightonbush?
Yeah, so I haven't been to Brightonbush since that happened, but I've seen some photos and videos of that. And I would say that especially when you're driving down the 224, the area that's immediately leading up to the Ripplebrook area, that was the area to me that really felt the most like you were driving through industrial forest land in some areas, just because of the extent of the clear cutting that was occurring right in that area. And that's, it's also an area that has a ton of old growth forest. And yeah, I was able to drive that. I was, lucky enough to go on a driving tour of the Highway 224 that was led by ODOT, but that some other conservation and river groups went on. And we did drive all the way past Ripple Brook. We didn't go onto the Highway 46, but we made a handful of stops back on the way to Estacada. And, like I said in that email, things kind of started out okay. It was great to be back, but as we got further down, we passed some of the danger tree operations and these big piles of logs and chip piles that looked like they were, 40 or 50 feet tall. And there was some pretty heavy logging that was going on. And we were able to walk around places like the Roaring River Campground and, the very sort of northern end of the Fish Creek drainage, and made some stops to look at some of these hillsides, where 100% of the trees have been cut down because it was said that they would slide down into the road. Basically, they had somebody go up onto the top of the hill and cut a tree down, and they saw how far down the tree would slide. And if it's, if the tree got anywhere close to the road, that meant that all the trees around it were also coming down. And, during that trip, I really realized that, given my experience with that area, I was looking at the forest with just a very different lens than the ODOT employees and the contractors that were working out there, many of which, had come from out of state, and it was their first time in the Pacific Northwest. And because these areas looked so unrecognizable to me, but I had obviously grown so connected to over the years, it was really sad to see.
Was this the same ODOT contractors that were notorious for doing some really invasive and destructive logging along Highway 22?
Yeah, so at that time, I think it was Mason Bruce and Gerard and CDR McGuire were the two companies that were implementing the roadside hazard tree removal project that was being managed by ODOT. And so some of those folks were out. And we did get to talk a lot about the definition of hazard trees and safety. And at that time, one of the things that was disturbing to me was that they were talking about how they were only about 20% done, according to them, with the work, which driving through, we were like, there's not any more hazard trees to remove here. How are you only 20% done? And they clarified that they had 80% of the trees that were left. They were going to come from way up along the top and of the cliffs over the highway. If you've driven down the 224, it's a really incised canyon and there's some pretty high cliffs above it. So taking trees out of those kinds of unstable areas is definitely a concern, just given erosion and slope stability. And then, their definition of a hazard tree at the time and their standard of cutting trees just kind of blew my mind. It was, their standard is if a tree has a 50% chance or more of dying within 3 years, they're cutting it down. That's an extremely low safety tolerance, and it means that there's thousands of additional trees that are out there slated for logging. Half of those might not die, and then the trees that do die, even a smaller percentage of those would pose any public safety hazard. A death of a tree doesn't equal a hazard. We saw on the tour countless of these fire-killed trees from 2002, from a fire in 2002, and then in 2014, they were still standing, and they had burned a second time in the Riverside fire. So it really goes to show there's a difference between the death of a tree and its definition in reality as a safety hazard.
Well, who was making the decision about what trees were going to get cut and what was a hazard tree?
Yeah, so that was the ODOT contractors, following the guidelines that seemed to be sort of ever-changing, and many of which were still in draft format when they were out there using them. So the people that were supposed to be on the ground making the decisions were also meant to be qualified arborists with a certain level of experience working in a post-fire environment. And that was actually one of the things that came forward during all the ODOT controversy of last spring, which was a lot of the whistleblowers brought to the media's attention that many of the people that were out there making these calls were not actually, certified arborist did not actually have that post-fire experience and had very little oversight and systems for tracking the work that was being done. And by the time the state started an audit on all of that work, there was already so much damage that had occurred. And, many of the whistleblowers' claims still haven't been followed up on, unfortunately.
Well, there was calls even from the state legislature to put an immediate halt to that logging, and Governor Brown didn't respond to that. Why do you think that was? What was the motivation for logging all these trees?
Right. Well, for one, ODOT had access to $300 million in FEMA funding to remove trees along Oregon highways that had a timeline on it. And, so of the work that they paid the contractors to do, 75% of that was eligible for reimbursement. And then on the Clackamas, something that was being talked about was that they might also even be able to make back the remaining 25% through settlement sales, which involved the Forest Service selling them the trees that they cut so they would remove the logs that they're stockpiling, and then they could turn those around and sell them. So there was kind of a insidious sort of cycle of of money that was happening, and so that was definitely one motivation.
What was the rush?
Right. So I think one part of that is there is the safety issue and sort of weighing the trade-offs there. There's also, the fact that they, when these trees die, there is a very brief period of time where they can be commercially viable before they start to rot. The beetles come in, they start boring into the wood, and it's not really sellable as merchantable timber anymore. You can't really sell it for profit. And so, the way to get the work done quickly is to make it a lucrative operation so somebody can make money off of those trees that then pays for the trees being removed. And, everybody's happy except for the public that uses that area and is used to the way that things are, as well as all the wildlife that use that habitat.
Well, from what I heard from you and also from Dan Sears and other people is that if they hadn't logged, this fire would have recovered. The forest would have recovered from this fire in a very healthy way. How has the logging impeded that kind of recovery?
Oh, well, there's in places like along the Highway 46, that old growth, that's not going to come back within anybody's lifetime. Cutting down old growth trees, you can't really make up for that type of high quality structure for wildlife and for carbon sequestration. It became pretty clear to us right away that these kinds of projects, although they are seemingly benign on the surface, they really fit in with the cumulative impacts of the thousands of acres of logging on private, state, federal forests that's happening post-fires on top of all the green timber sales that are continuing to happen statewide. That all of that, it undercuts the natural carbon sequestration and storage capacity that burned forests have, contributes to carbon emissions, not to mention disrupting the forest health, degrading that critical post-fire habitat, harming the watersheds, aquatic ecosystems, taking all that woody debris out of the system that could end up in the stream networks and really contribute to restoring these streams that were, many of them, clear-cut, 50 to 100 years ago, right up to the stream, and don't have that kind of that woody structure that's so critical to the organisms that depend on it. So, taking that out of the system can really have pretty detrimental impacts for the long term.
You're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Michael Krotka, BARC's Forest Watch Coordinator, about post-fire logging in the Mount Hood National Forest. Well, now that you've completely depressed us about the incredible damage that's been done by ODOT and the Forest Service in the aftermath of last year's fires, particularly along the Clackamas River, the Riverside Fire, I wanted to talk about some rays of hope, because Bark did not stop there. And I'm wondering what your first thoughts were when you got out of that helicopter in terms of what was Bark's role to make sure that this didn't continue.
Right. So after seeing all of this work that ODOT was doing and the results of that on the ground, and also talking to some of the Forest Service employees that had been out to that part of the forest and were on that trip, that, you know, I got the impression they didn't like that too much either. We started really focusing on what was still coming, which was the proposals that the Forest Service was planning to do on national forest roads, so deeper into the forest. Planning had started on some of those projects, but it hadn't been approved yet. So the Riverside Lionshead Fire, they affected about 220 miles of national forest roads that were considered open, quote unquote, before the fires. And so to reopen those roads, the Forest Service said that on top of all the work happening on 224, they had to remove any of the hazard trees along these less used Forest Service roads off of the main highways. And to do that, they were planning on using what's called a categorical exclusion, or a CE, to the public NEPA process. So again, reduced opportunity for input via the regular public comment periods and really fast track timeline. And they said that they were able to do that because this was all for road maintenance. Even though we knew they were planning to do this work as commercial and offer it as commercial timber sales, meaning it would be for profit. They wanted to get this done quickly before the timber was lost to decay, like we talked about. They had limited funding to do it. And the work, it was big. You know, we're talking tens of millions of dollars of costs. So unfortunately, though, that timber sale component of this process is not legally consistent with their definition of road maintenance, which requires greater scrutiny. So there was recent court rulings on that. And so we were really engaged for many months with this. We knew that there are many roads out there that the Forest Service did not need to reopen, at least not right away. And they knew that too. And months went by before any decision came out on this. But when it did, actually, the Mountain National Forest really stood out to me compared to the other forests, like the Willamette National Forest next door, for example, and the way that they really did engage with the input that they received by the public. You know, obviously, they were not oblivious to the controversy around ODOT's activities. There was tons of media covering that, and multiple protests and rallies calling for agencies to do the right thing. You know, a few months before that decision came out, the Forest Service NEPA coordinator actually called me to talk through the proposal and try to get a sense of, you know, what would need to happen for conservation groups to be okay, or at least to be able to live with what was going to happen and not litigate, essentially. And that, you know, that rarely happens, and that felt pretty huge to me. So we discussed these proposals and a number of meetings that we had with the Forest Service on that ODOT field trip. And, you know, the district ranger for the Forest Service at that point, for the Clackamas River Ranger District, she was on that trip. I had a hunch she didn't really like what she saw. Since then, she actually transitioned to a new position right as this decision was being finalized, which I kind of have to speculate that gave her some flexibility to approve a response to our concerns that might have otherwise been kind of a more risky endeavor. And then another big factor, I think, is that the Mountain National Forest right now, I think they really do want to avoid litigation. You know, last year they lost in court to Bark and other conservation groups when they were sued over a controversial and illegal project, which they explicitly planned without collaborative input in order to fast track it. So, you know, it sounds kind of familiar. And it does make sense that they didn't want to make that mistake again. So just to get into some of the things that we asked for and how it was responded to, you know, we asked for them to be specific about the roads that they would be cutting trees along, prioritizing roads based on clear criteria, not cutting trees on unneeded or these low-use roads, and instead taking a new sort of hard look at the road system post-fire, meaning they might need to overhaul their roads plan, which is pretty much made obsolete by these fires. We also asked them to not cut trees that were really far from the road, so over like a what's called a site potential tree height away from the road. And to really just in general approach these projects with a lot of patience and not just go in there and hastily cut trees that might not fail. And, you know, lastly, related to that, we asked them to provide some more solid project design criteria and more clear rationale for the individual tree removal. And the response was surprising, and it was a pleasant surprise. They agreed to drop any proposed logging along roads that were known to be closed, low or medium use even, and any roads that they had plans to close in the future, they also dropped those from the proposal, and to instead keep those areas closed until this further analysis can be performed. So they actually did commit to performing the subsequent comprehensive analysis of the current National Forest road system after these high intensity fires, you know, to audit what the needs were, because it's a changed landscape, right? And so they might be closing roads that maybe they made sense on the landscape before these fires, but they might not make sense anymore. But they're going to determine what those roads are before they are going to be going in and cutting any more trees down than they have to.
Well, what are they going to cut? What's left to cut?
Well, so it ends up now that they're talking about 152 miles of the high and very high priority roads. So that's down from around 220. So they got rid of about 100 individual roads, around 67 miles. So that's thousands of acres. And also, they also recently recognized that 152 miles of roads, only about, I should say about 35% of that mileage, there's no danger trees on those. So it's going to be even less than that. But so the trees that are left that they're going to be looking at, they kind of have their definition of a hazard tree. You know, it's most dead trees, unfortunately, which that's problematic, like we've already talked about. And then trees that have a likely failure, quote unquote, potential within a striking distance of a road. And so, you know, the way they look at these individual trees, it involves looking at the bark, you know, how much bark char, how much crown scorch. So that's a term that just means, you know, what percentage of the tree canopy is burned off. And, you know, which again, on their own, those don't directly relate to safety hazards. There's still, the tree has to be within striking distance. There's things like tree lean, you know, the height of the tree, the slope, you know, the percentage of the exposed roots. There's lots and lots of things to consider. And I think that is, it's something that speaks to the importance of staying vigilant on these projects as they're being planned. Because there is still a pretty enormous amount of roadside tree removal that's being proposed. And potentially, we're going to be seeing some more subsequent road analysis and comment periods for additional roads to be considered for the same kind of activity. So it's important to be tracking that.
Well, how successful do you feel you've been so far in changing the direction that the Forest Service is taking?
For this project specifically?
Yes.
I think I'd like to call it a success, given that so much of the road system that they were originally looking at, they're not considering that anymore, and are really taking a much more nuanced approach. You know, I think that the agency recognized their decision as it's written now. It's going to allow for that treatment of danger trees, actual danger trees along the most important roads, saving some of the other important decisions for later, because they don't need to be made now. There's no urgency to open these roads that are spur roads off to nowhere. We can save that for future conversations. And I think that's pretty huge. You know, they came up with a rating criteria that they're going to be using to prioritize roads. And it seems like this future analysis, it's a solid attempt at being responsive to requests that were made to consider dropping logging along roads that are, you know, categorized as being really low use, low maintenance. And, I'm hoping this coming planning process is also going to include more public involvement and a harder look at the need for roads within the fire perimeter. And, those are most of the things that we were initially asking for when we were responding to this. I think that all of us at BARC and in the conservation community in general, we all recognize that we want to have a safe landscape out there, and access to the forest is really important, and there are trade-offs that we need to consider. We can't just leave all safety hazards in the forest, especially along these highways, for people to encounter. It doesn't create a safe environment for people, and we do want to encourage people to go out and experience the forest and use the forest and feel safe in the forest. So I think that overall this has been a really good collaboration and finding of middle ground in our case. I just wish that some of the other forests around Oregon kind of took note of the Mountain National Forest's approach and followed suit. I think there's still potential for that to happen, but unfortunately, it looks like it's going to have to happen through something like a lawsuit.
Well, actually, next week we'll be talking about the lawsuits that are pending in the Willamette National Forest. Are there still trees that are going to be taken out along highways 224 and 46, or have they done all the cutting that they're planning on doing?
So along the 224, there's actually a pretty great dashboard that's on the internet that where you can go on there and look at all the different fires and ODOT's activities and how much work they've done versus how much they project. And so right now it looks like the Riverside fire, I'm just looking at this now, they're about 68% done according to their projected total estimated hazard trees. So it looks like they've removed, according to this dashboard along the Clackamas corridor, a little less than 17,000 trees, and they have about 25,000 total. And so those numbers actually are much lower than the numbers that we were given on the ODOT field trip. And so it's good to hear that these estimates of trees being removed and trees needed to be removed is going down. That's a good thing to hear. The work on the 46, I don't think is done yet. That's going to be the Forest Service once they start implementing their roadside danger tree removal work, which, from the looks of it, from what I saw, there wasn't that much more left to cut on Highway 46 that was an immediate hazard. But again, I didn't get to drive down that road. I was flying over it. So that's a bird's eye view isn't always the best. It's great for some things, but not for the, tree by tree kind of detail that I think would be required to answer that question. I will say that BARC finally did get permission to go into the Riverside Fire area to look at some of the beaver and wetland sites that we've been studying, and we're going to be going into some of those areas, I think, actually next week. And so pretty soon I'll have a bit more to share about what things look like on the ground along the 224 and kind of up in and around that Ripplebrook area.
Well, let's do a show about that when you've got something to report back on.
Yeah, that would be great. You talk about wetlands and beaver and how they interact with all of this.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on Kibwe Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KPFG, LPFM, KODX, LPFM, KMUN, and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Michael Krotka, who's BARC's Forest Watch Coordinator. And we're talking about the post-fire logging in the Mount Hood National Forest. Well, in the last part of the show, I'd like to talk about how we approach returning to this forest that has been so much transformed, particularly those of us who have spent years hiking and camping and just enjoying the immense uniqueness of the Clackamas watershed. So, what kinds of advice do you have for those of us as we return to the forest?
Well, I think overall it is going to take a lot of getting used to, but it's important to remember, I think, that the forest that all of us had gotten used to before these fires, it was actually shaped by very large, severe fires that happened in our region, 110, 120 years ago. And it does take some time for the forest to regrow in some places, like Fish Creek. But it's important to remember that this is it's a needed stage in forest development, which has its own value and which will create what I hope to be a healthier landscape in the long term. But things are going to look different when people come back. And, there's something like 30 miles of designated trail in the Clackamas that were affected. And so, just like in the Eagle Creek fire, there's going to be a lot of work that needs to be done before people can use these trails and go to some of these areas and have the same kinds of experience that they're expecting. The Eagle Creek fire, that has trails and campgrounds that they're still closed, 4 or 5 years later. So in comparison, the Riverside fire was much larger, like we talked about. I think it was almost three times as large. So it may be a while until all of the trails and other recreation areas that people really love are reopened, and they are going to look different. That's going to take something to get used to. But one of my favorite trails along the Clackamas River, and I'm sure you've probably hiked this trail, the Clackamas River Trail, which burned in the early 2000s. Granted, it was a different kind of fire. It was not as severe as some parts of the Riverside fire. But it really only took a few years after it was regenerating and beautiful, and it ended up being a lot of people's favorite place to go in the Clackamas River. If people have been out to the Eagle Creek Trail, out to Punchbowl Falls, that reopened this year, I really encourage people to go there to see what that looks like. I think it's even more beautiful than it was before the fire.
Yeah, I found that actually about a lot of places in the gorge, particularly Wakena Falls, which is amazing and has all these different types of fire landscape. And it's such an incredible natural lesson about what fire does to the forest. Well, as we're talking, I am looking at this photograph that I've had hanging in my studio for many, many years. And it's a photograph of Mount Hood from Highway 35 taken in the late 1920s. And 35 was a dirt road in those days. And I've had this photograph for probably 40 years or more, but I think I looked at it really closely after the fire last year and realized that all the forests on the left side of the highway are burned. They're just a lot of snags. So this is some major fire that happened on Mount Hood back in the 1920s or maybe before that. And of course, this area now is just verdant. And to me, it's a real lesson in how landscapes change and how one must be patient, or one must, I mean, for me, I'm getting kind of old, so I accept that I'm never going to see the Clackamas River back as a full verdant forest as the forest along Highway 35 is. But what kind of lessons can we learn from like thinking about old burns or like the Yuccol burn, which was still visible in parts when I first moved to Oregon in 1971? You could still see parts of it from Hamilton Mountain, and now there's no trace of it at all. So what can we learn?
There's so much I think that we can learn from fire and thinking about these landscapes in the long term. I think that a lot of the lessons learned, they really go against the dominant fire sort of narrative and paradigm of full suppression. But I think learning from the past, that allowing and even promoting these natural processes like fire to occur in some areas can really promote positive change. And we can't continue to assume that we can and should be able to put out all fires. That's just an impossible task. And I think also when you were talking about looking at the mountain and kind of its change over time, it made me think about the glaciers and climate change. And I think that one lesson that I think a lot of people learn from this past experience, living through the Labor Day fires, is there's no place is safe from climate change, quote unquote, safe. It's not an abstract thing that's happening in an abstract place. It's happening here, and I've seen sort of the mainstream narrative has shifted, I think, somewhat more towards these recent fires being climate fires or wind-driven weather events with fire added, not as much fuels driven, at least on the west side, like they often are. When you go east of the Cascades, I think more people understand that. And so that's something to consider too when we're thinking about the role of fire on the landscape in the future, its natural role. What is What's an appropriate amount of fire on the landscape? I don't know if anyone has the answer to that question. Our society, unfortunately, we really like these black and white common sense solutions to problems that we face. And I think addressing fire really requires holding multiple, sometimes conflicting ideas all at once. We need fire on the landscape. It's also destructive and harmful. In some places we can stop it, other places we can't. Some places we can intervene and promote recovery, while other times we really shouldn't, and things can recover even better on their own. Some places have evolved with and really depend on these hot, initially destructive fires, which I'm sure the fires that you saw along the Highway 35 corridor, that's higher elevation, moist mixed conifer. That forest type has really evolved with these like episodic high severity fire events that really reset the landscape and provide a lot of benefits. So, I think changing this dominant wildfire paradigm and of, full suppression, fire is bad, fire destroys forests, and really putting more focus, especially out here on the west side, on community preparedness, getting fire back onto the landscape where it's needed. And also putting intention into where people are rebuilding after these fires happen and how we do it, thinking about things like home hardening, defensive space, better protocols for power companies, so we don't see fires starting from power lines like we saw in 2020 and in other years and down in California. So yeah, I think there's an enormous amount of sort of re-examining our relationship to fire and to forests, and thinking about, how we can coexist with these events that are surely to occur more often in the future.
Well, I'm wondering if we compare this fire to other really big fires, like the famous Big Burn of 1910 that burnt much of western Montana, Idaho, and eastern Washington. And I think it was a bigger fire than what happened in Oregon last year. But if we put that in the context of climate change, do you think that we can draw parallels from past fires and see, yes, this fire that burned last year was really enormous and ground changing, and yet was natural, and it ultimately will be good? Or do you think that climate change puts another unknown in there that can make us a little bit more uneasy?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of both. I think it's true. I've heard it often said that these fires, the Labor Day fires, they were unusual, but they were not unprecedented. And I think that's true. We had these strong east winds that they're kind of Oregon's version of the Santa Ana winds down in California, although they happen much less frequently here. But there were really similar conditions. And a prime factor in some of the fires you mentioned, the really infamous ones like the 1902 fires that burned, over 1 million acres, and the big Tillamook burn in the 1930s. So that, it's not unprecedented per se, and they are also consistent with what climate and fire ecologists are talking about in terms of what we're more likely to see with climate change, more of these extreme weather events. And so I think that is something to really consider in terms of, what's the interaction of human infrastructure, human communities, with some of the non-human communities and natural infrastructure out there, and how all of these things interact and how they relate to the way that fire burns on the landscape.
Well, Michael, it's really good to talk to you. Thanks so much for being on Locus Focus.
Thank you so much again for having me. I love your show. It's been great talking.
And we'll talk again in a couple months after you've done some more ground truthing.
Sounds good.
We've been talking with Michael Kratka with BARC, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KIBU Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to a podcast on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KIBU Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KABU staff, who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KABU on the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. And you can help us by becoming a member of KABU or renewing your membership if you're already a member. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or please support the community station you're listening to right now. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Next week, we'll get an update from Rebecca White with Cascadia Wildlands about a slew of lawsuits to stop post-fire clear-cutting in the Willamette National Forest. We'll go out with some music by Tracy Nelson. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, wash your hands, get your COVID shots, and remember to socially distance when necessary and wear a mask. Nothing.